chromosomes. Little strands of nucleic acids and proteins are the fundamental genetic instructions that tell us who we are at birth. Most people are born with 46 chromosomes, but each year in the United States, about 6,000 people are born with an extra chromosome, making them a person with Down syndrome. If you've ever encountered someone with Down syndrome, you know that they are some of the kindest, most joyful people you will ever meet. They truly have something extra. My name is Lisa Nichols, and I have spent the last 24 years as both the CEO of Technology Partners and as the mother to Allie. Allie has something extra in every sense of the word. I have been blessed to be by her side as she impacts everyone she meets. Through these two important roles as CEO and mother to Allie, I have witnessed countless life lessons that have fundamentally changed the way I look at the world. While you may not have an extra chromosome, every leader has something extra that defines who you are. Join me as I explore the something extra in leaders from all walks of life and discover how that difference in each of them has made a difference in their companies, their families, their communities, and in themselves. I'm thrilled to have Chris Crane on the show today. Chris is the CEO and co-founder of Edify. If you like this episode today, please go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and leave us a 5-star rating. So, Chris, I cannot even tell you how delighted I am that you are making time to be on the Something Extra podcast today. I've been looking forward to this conversation.
Thank you, Lisa. You are such a great leader, and I've served under your leadership in the past, and it's really exciting to have this time with you to talk about leading and being better leaders.
Yes. Well, we've got so much to talk about, Chris. And I want to talk a little bit about how you and I met. We met through an organization called YPO, and you've been part of YPO for a very long time. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that. But before we go into that, I want to know, I know right now you're sitting in San Diego, California. I'm sitting in St. Louis, Missouri. I'm so grateful for technology and that can connect us like this. But did you grow up in San Diego, or did you grow up on the East Coast?
I grew up on the East Coast in New Jersey. My dad would commute into New York City every day. And then when I was 16, 17, and 18 years old, he'd get me a clerk job at the firm he was working at. And basically, I would just work with the real clerks, and I was kind of a gopher, and they'd say, hey, we need this from the warehouse, or we need this, you know, go chase down this document. So I spent the summer chasing down documents in various buildings in Lower Manhattan.
But the point is, Chris, your dad had you working, and he built a very strong work ethic into you, and you're still using that to this day. So that's the greater point there, right?
It is. And I think that when you look at entrepreneurs, almost always they're being entrepreneurial. I had a lawn mowing business, a driveway snow shoveling business, that there were people that they were doing that other, you know, selling Christmas cards in July to our neighbors. Getting into entrepreneurship early on, like 13, 14, 15 years old, and then always having summer jobs, that's really important.
Yes, I cannot agree more. Well, I know that you're married to your wonderful wife, Jane. I think you guys have been married for, I don't know, over 30 years for sure, right? You've got one son, Andy.
Yes, in this coming year, it'll be 40 years, and Andy's 36 years old.
Oh my goodness. Congratulations. Congratulations, Chris. I know that family is very important to you, and you and I've talked about this. We're still looking for those significant others for our sons, aren't we? timing.
Could I introduce you to my son?
And I do exactly the same thing. I'm always scouting, but let's go on and talk. So you grew up, and that really explains, because you got your bachelor's in finance from Boston College.
Yes.
And you went to the Institute of European Studies in Vienna, Austria. You have econ, music, and art appreciation there. And then you received your MBA from Harvard. So that kind of explains, you grew up on the East Coast, so then you were part of East Coast colleges. But now, let me ask you this. I could be wrong on this. I know that you and our mutually dear friend, Alan Morris, were both at Harvard, but did you meet at Harvard, Chris, or did you meet somewhere else?
So we met through the, there's a subset, as you know so well, Lisa, because you led it, there's a subgroup of YPO called the Christian Fellowship Network. And so Alan and I met in that around 1995. It had been dormant, and Alan had an interest in reviving it. I did too. And so we decided, let's get together and let's go put on a conference together. So we did the first one in 1997 called Vision and Values. But Alan and I really became good friends through that. And we're just, I've stayed at his house in Florida. And he, you know, of course, he's come to San Diego for the first event we did do in San Diego. So it's just, we have been good friends over the last 25 years.
Yes. Well, I didn't know if you guys met through YPO, the CFN for YPO, or through Harvard, but you know, you brought that up. So we did something very special this year in February, and you guys co-chaired the very first Vision and Values. And Chris, thank you so much, because you said, we'll do the 25th. And we just had the 25th in Miami in February, and it was just so much fun. It was so cool to come full circle again with the two of you.
It was great fun. We had lots of great speakers, great attendees, people, just everyone, members and spouses seemed to really enjoy it. But of course, you've been the leader of the Christian Fellowship Network of YPO for 4 years, Lisa, and so your leadership really set the stage and helped us attract lots of great speakers.
Well, thank you. I appreciate those kind words, but I want to say some kind words about you. So I had the privilege, Chris, of working with my good friend, John Rulin, on an artifact mug. And this artifact mug for both you and Alan was created by an artist. And so in so doing that, I had to gather a lot of different information about both of you. And I'm just gonna read a few things here, not to embarrass you, but I just want our listeners to understand the person that we're talking to here, Chris, because I think you're just a remarkable human being. I really do. But, you know, one of the questions I had to answer was, what are some of the things about Chris and, or Christopher, you know, and you were a businessman for 25 years. You love like helping people, Christian education, microfinance, giving people a hand up rather than a hand out. You're doing social entrepreneurism now, and we're going to talk a lot about that. Children, helping people lift themselves out of poverty. You went to Harvard. You went to Boston College. You had a technology company. There's so much there. You also love opera. And I learned that about you in the middle of that artifact mug that we had created for you. But another question that the artist had asked me was, give me some character qualities about Chris. And I'm just going to name a few of these here again, not to embarrass you, Chris, but just to really just say the admiration that I have for you. But when I think of Chris Crane, I think of humility. You have razor intellect. There's no doubt about that, but you're one of the most humble people I've met. You've always got a smile on your face. You have contagious joy. You're a global thinker, always lifting people up, affirming and encouraging. You were so affirming to me in my leadership of CFN. I'll never forget the very first year. And you wrote me this really nice note and just said, you know, how much you appreciated my leadership and the things that you saw. That's an affirmation, just part of your DNA. And then vision. So, you know, not to embarrass you, Chris, but I mean, those are the things that I see in you and other people see in you.
Thank you, Lisa. You're kind to say that, and it was very nice to hear. Thank you.
All right. So I want to talk about your first business. Well, actually, you had a few businesses that didn't work, right? You did have some businesses, and I don't call it failure. You know, Chris, it's an opportunity to learn, but you did have some businesses that didn't work. What did you learn from those experiences?
So I always wanted to be an entrepreneur, Lisa. And so like most entrepreneurs, you have a few failures first, and then and it's just you keep adjusting, adapting. Wow, okay, this didn't work. What was I? Gee, I didn't, didn't foresee the capital we needed. I didn't form the, didn't get the right team together, didn't pursue the market well enough or have a compelling enough service or product. So those are all helpful to do. And it's interesting, I did take in a round of private equity in the company that did work out, and from a great firm and Summit Partners. And as I was talking to the partner who served on our board, he said they would much rather finance an entrepreneur who had a failure and a success than two successes. The ones that have had two successes, they know everything. The ones that have had a failure and a success, they're the ones that are much more open, more humble, and they listen to advice.
Oh, that's great. I love that. Well, okay. So then you did put up your life savings. I know.
Yeah.
You know, Jane's blessing upon Jane's blessing and God's blessing, right? You put up your life savings to purchase. And I guess it was maybe not failing, but it was in need of a refresh, maybe. And that was Comps Info System. And you did that in August 1992. Tell us a little bit about that business. And I know that you made 13 different acquisitions. And tell us a little bit about that journey, Chris.
Thanks, Lisa. It was a turnaround situation. It had money, and so the bad news, it had lost money for 5 years in a row. But the good news is companies that have lost money for 5 years in a row are cheap to buy. And so, and we didn't have much money, Jane and I. So Jane was fully supportive, and we just put up our life savings. And because we did the research, the due diligence, we got lots of advice from others. And actually, a lot of our fellow YPO friends who were CEOs of companies, they advised against it. They said, wow, 5 years of losses in a row, this is too much. And it's a recession now in 1992. And this doesn't really make sense. But the three that I really spoke with about almost 20, I got advice from about 20 people. The three that said, yes, do it, they all had bought and sold companies before. So they could, the others really had started their own companies. They saw a real opportunity here. And a great mentor, friend of mine, Merrill Oster, he's 10 years older than I, he just said, hey, this is a, he had had an information company. This was a, Comps Info Systems was a commercial real estate information company. When an office building, industrial building, retail building, or apartment complex sold, we would collect up to 200 data fields on that and then sell that to commercial real estate brokers, lenders, and appraisers. And Merrill had a financial information business, and he looked it over. He sent his CFO out to help me really do the analysis. And then he spent a weekend with me. I flew back to Iowa, where he was headquartered at the time. And he said, this is a diamond in the rough. If you do these five things, if you take these five steps, you will turn this company around. So it was like painting by the numbers. I did those five things that Merrill said, and it turned around within a year. Within a year, we were the power of mentoring.
The power of mentoring. Well, there's so much packed in there, Chris. I mean, the power of mentoring, but then also you having the humility to know that you didn't know everything, you know, and that's really the coachable part that you were talking about before with that venture capital firm. But what were those five things? Do you remember now, Chris? What were the five things he told you?
Let's see. Yeah, he said, the gentleman who owned the company, who founded it and owned the company before you, he said he was pricing based on his cost. He wasn't pricing based on the value in the marketplace. So he said, you should raise your prices because this product is clearly the best. There was a competitor, a large company, TRW, had, you know, was a conglomerate that had, you know, lots of different businesses, but they had $8 billion in sales. So it's scary to be up against a company that has a division that competes against you, but had much more market share than they did because their quality wasn't as good. And so so he said, increase prices. He said, this company has too few salespeople. The information business is a top line business. Your big cost is collecting that data. Then you want to sell that to as many people as you possibly can. So he said, triple your sales force. And we did, and sales went up. And because the cost of goods sold is only about 10% on every new customer we get. Let's say someone subscribed to all of our information in Dallas for $10,000. Well, it was costing us about $100 to, about maybe $1,000 at most, to deliver that per year, and it's $9,000 of gross margin. So we dramatically increased the salespeople, and then he said, "Gee, you're a California, Arizona regional business. this is a valuable product. Someone is going to do this service nationally. And I said, oh, yeah, there are a bunch of players around the country. He said, well, either you become the national player, and that means acquiring a lot of them, or one of them's going to be, somebody else is going to be the national player, and they're going to acquire you at a much lower price. So we decided, okay, we better take in private equity to go and start acquiring. And so we did acquire 13 of those other companies. Let's see what else he said.
That's amazing. He gave you the blueprint, Chris.
Yeah, it was just a blueprint, and I've got it written down somewhere. But
that's amazing.
We just carefully implemented those five things, and it was just whenever I'd have a significant challenge, I'd call up Merrill. I'd say, Merrill, here's what's going on. Here's the problem, and here's what I'm thinking about doing. And he'd usually say, yeah, you know, when I had that problem, what you're thinking about doing is what I did, and it didn't work. It failed. But here's what I did the second and third and fourth time that I had that problem, and it did work. So he'd tell me. So it was just invaluable. So he's just a wonderful, loving man, just did it out of great caring, because he had mentored numerous other people.
Oh, wow. The power of mentoring, for sure. I always say, be a mentor and have a mentor, right? At all times, Chris, you've got to be a mentor and have a mentor. Well, okay. So you ended up selling that. I mean, you ended up growing that, obviously turning it around, making it very profitable. You did the things that Merrill had suggested that you do. And then you ended up selling that company. So that was officially, maybe unofficially, retirement for you. But then you got tapped on the shoulder. You had been a donor to Opportunity International. Greg and I have been on the board of governors now for I don't even know how many years. Love that organization, microfinance. You got tapped on the shoulder to come in and run Opportunity International. And tell me what went through your mind. Well, first of all, tell our listeners, because they may not know about Opportunity, but tell them, first of all, what that is, and then tell me what went through your mind when you got tapped on the shoulder for that position.
Yes, so I sold CompSimple Systems, and it was now a couple of years later, and I was serving on both for-profit and nonprofit boards, and then the then CEO called me up and said he was going to be moving on, and they've got a search firm, and they've got a bunch of candidates, but he said he'd nominate me to take his place, and I said, oh, I don't know anything about running a nonprofit. I'm a for-profit guy, and gosh, I just don't think this is a fit at all. And he said, well, you've told me you really want to learn more about microfinance. And if you go through the interview process, you'll learn a lot more. So why don't you just talk to the recruiter? So he was a good salesman. And so I talked to the recruiter and then said, wow, this is pretty interesting. This is, although it's a nonprofit, it's a whole lot like running business where they're not just giving things away, they're making loans to people at that time in 28 developing nations through their local microfinance lending partners, and the people would pay back the loans monthly. So they'd pay back the loans in installment payments. Sometimes they'd make weekly payments. So I thought long and hard about it, and again got Merrill Oster's advice, and he just encouraged me to do it. And I think one of the things that was really helpful to me is I thought of myself being 90 years old in a rocking chair, and looking back at my life, and gee, would I be happier if I went into microfinance, was able to help a lot of people by providing them a loan so they could work their way, have a little business and work their way out of poverty, or just having served on a bunch of boards for the prior 40 years or so? And I thought, well, I really would much prefer at that time to be looking back and saying, hey, I did this work that really helped a lot of people in developing nations. So I took the job, and gosh, a lot of principles I've learned in business apply, but a lot do not. In fact, I heard a professor give a talk once, and I was actually at my MBA reunion. I think it was probably my 25th MBA reunion. And the professor, they found out that 90% of all of the MBAs who had graduated 10 years or more before, they were serving on nonprofit boards. So they said, come back to your reunion 2 days early. And we've got this course for nonprofit directors. And I thought, wow, this is great. So I went back, and he said, you for-profit executives, said, you get on the board of a nonprofit, you think all of your business principles that you've learned apply to that nonprofit. He says, they don't. He said only half apply. And the problem is you don't know which half applies. So that was very helpful to me. So to realize let's say we'd have a situation at Opportunity International. I'd say, I wouldn't say, hey, let's just do this. I'd say, well, would this make sense? Because sometimes it didn't in a nonprofit.
Right. Oh, my goodness. Well, Chris, we've got so much more to talk about, but we do need to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back with Chris Crane on the Something Extra podcast.
In business, the tendency is to seek out partners who are bigger, faster, stronger. When it comes to IT, you should be looking for smarter, faster, better. That's just what you'll find with the talented technologists at Technology Partners. Our experts develop custom solutions to tackle your most complex challenges, all to simplify your processes in the smartest, most efficient way possible. The time to be swift and nimble starts now. Go to technologypartners.net/solutions and see what's possible.
Welcome back to the Something Extra podcast with Chris Crane. So Chris, we were talking about OI. There are some listeners out there. I know I've talked about OI before on the podcast, but there's some listeners out there that may not even really know about OI. Can you tell a little bit more about OI and you know what the mission and the vision is of the organization?
Yes, Opportunity International makes loans to people living in poverty. And they've established operations in 20 different countries. They've established microfinance institutions in those countries that will make loans to, typically it's a $200, $400, $600 loan that people pay back sometimes in a short, they'll pay weekly payments. They pay it back in 6 months, but sometimes 4 months, but getting that money allows them to buy inventory, allows them to maybe purchase or lease a stall in the marketplace. It puts them on the map. It puts them another rung up the ladder to be able to make more money to provide for their family, to feed their families and provide their children education, to provide health care. And it's very transformational. And the current CEO, my successor with a few people in between, is Atul Tandon, who's doing a wonderful job leading Opportunity International. And of course, as you know, Lisa, he's got the goal to wipe out poverty. He's got a big dream of the 7 going on 8 billion people in the world to try to reach all of them with microfinance loans and other financial services. And they emphasize agriculture finance to they'll make a loan to a farmer, but they also share better farming techniques. The farmer will double or triple their crop production. They make loans to schools so that the schools can build more classrooms to educate children. So they're doing such good work.
Yes. Well, you know, one thing that I do want to, before we move into what you're doing today with Edify, Chris, you know, there is a Christian aspect to OI. And I know I had read or watched a TED talk or something that you had done. And you said that you did, when you were CEO, you did have people say, you should take that part out, because if you take that out, then you can raise a lot more money. And I thought your response was really funny to that. Can you tell the response that you had to that?
Yes, when I joined Opportunity International, it was one of three U.S.-based microfinance institutions, organizations that was making loans in developing countries. So, but there are three larger ones that are based in the U.S., a bunch of smaller ones. We were all about the same size. So people, and we would say, hey, we're making loans in the name of Jesus to help people work their way out of poverty. And we try to share Jesus with them when they come together to make their weekly payment. There's a worship time, singing and prayer, and the locals. These aren't foreigners doing the leading. It's locals are leading and talking about the scriptures. And so, but people say, oh, leave out the whole thing about Jesus. Just become secular. You'll raise more money. Well, fast forward 7 years later, Opportunity was raising more money than the other two combined. So I said, gee, I understand your logic. You think that would work, but just the actual...
The numbers prove something different, right?
In fact, because there are so many philanthropists who are Christians that want to give to an organization that will share the gospel. And in my Christian worldview, I think it's so important to marry the great commandment. The Lord told us to love God and love your neighbor. So help your neighbor, and especially that poor people are really important to help. That's number one. Combine that with the Great Commission, where Jesus told us to share the gospel of Jesus Christ, to tell people about the love of Jesus, integrity of Jesus. And so we try to combine the two in our work with people in developing countries.
Yes, I love that. Well, let's talk about what you're doing today. So in 2009, you co-founded Edify with Tiger Dawson. And Edify, you know, your mission is to improve and expand sustainable, Christ-centered education globally. The vision is flourishing godly nations. We partner with education entrepreneurs who own low-fee, independent, Christ-centered schools in 11 different countries. Now, it could be more than that now. We've impacted education for over 1.4 million students. And I know I read somewhere, Chris, that your goal is 4 million students. So I don't know where you are on that trajectory of reaching that goal, but this is the mission of Edify. So what brought you to making that decision that this is where you were going to head after OI?
Yes. So I was at Opportunity International at the time, and I heard a British professor of education who had done 7 years of research, and he was the pioneer in identifying that although there are public schools for many, but not all children living in poverty in developing nations, he said there are well over a million what we call low-fee independent schools. So they are generally started by a poor person in a poor community, sometimes because they want to give a good education to their own children. And so they go and they start with a kindergarten, and they'll have 7, 9, 12 kids that first year. And then but the end of the year, the parents go, gosh, you have to have a first grade now because you did such a good job with our children that they're way ahead of the other children in the public schools. So then they have to move out of their shack, their little home, and they rent a place or they buy some land and they start building a classroom, and they borrow from friends and family to do that. And so we catch up with them when they have 8 or 10 classrooms, because if they have 250 children or more and they're charging 50 cents to a dollar per day per student, they will be fully financially sustainable. No donations from anybody, no government subsidies. It sounds like such a small amount of money, but at first I was so skeptical, but we now work with, we partner with 12,000 of these low-fee independent schools, virtually all of them run by a local entrepreneur, a poor person who didn't set out necessarily to be an entrepreneur, and they do a much better job. The studies show that on the national exams, that the children in these schools score significantly higher typically than children from the public schools, where the teachers in the public schools are unionized, they can't get fired, and so they're often absent, or when they're at school, sometimes they're only teaching half of that time. So where the school run by that entrepreneur, for the entrepreneur to feed his or her family, about 50% of the schools are run by a woman, 50% by men. They have to provide a good education service. So they make sure their teachers show up, that they're prepared, and they are in those classrooms teaching. And the parents really appreciate that. And so the parents will sacrifice. Sometimes they'll go from eating 2 meals a day to only 1 meal a day to pay that 50 cents, 5 cents per child so that they can get a much better education. Because they know it's their children's one chance in life to escape the dire poverty of working in the high heat and the high humidity and African, Latin American countries, just working outside in menial labor. Here's a chance to work their way into a middle-class job, to get the education that they need to be able to get a good job.
Yeah, education is the key. I do believe that too, Chris. And you say education is social justice. And yes. Leveling the playing field for these children to get the same type of education that another child. It's the game changer, really. It's the game changer.
Nelson Mandela said, education is the pathway out of poverty.
What is next for Edify? I mean, I know, how many kids are you impacting today, and what is your goal? And how are you tracking toward that goal?
So now 12,000 schools, about 3.2 million children. So we don't have any schools. I should rapidly say that, rush to say that. It's all, we just partner with these entrepreneurs who do so much with so little. Like, they're my heroes. But we have our vice president of Latin America. She is Peruvian, Bettina Gomez Garcia. She's come up with an approach, a disruptive innovation to scale much more quickly in Latin America. We have a young leader, a 35-year-old Ugandan man. He's now been promoted to vice president of East Africa, but he entered Uganda less than 4 years ago and with a greenfield startup. We had no partner schools. Today, we have 6,000 partner schools in Uganda because he's come up with a way to rapidly scale and to leverage volunteers, school entrepreneurs who want to help other school entrepreneurs. And so he's now in one country that's in one of our newest countries of entry, Uganda. We have 50% of all our partner schools in that country. So, and he now wants to take that model to other countries in Africa.
So amazing. So amazing. Well, I want you to tell our listeners at the end how they can get involved in Edify if they want to. But I've got a couple more questions for you, Chris, before we move into something extra. But I know faith is so important to you. And I want you to tell our listeners, how do you believe that faith has really impacted your leadership?
Thanks, Lisa. I think it's helped me. You know, Jesus emphasizes so much that it just so many times in the Bible, it emphasizes humility. It emphasizes listening to others. It emphasizes being genuinely caring. And then by some of the Christian organizations I belong to, it's introduced me to people like my mentor, one of my three great mentors, Meryl Oster, who then shares great principles like hire only A players. So an A player is someone who is really good at what they do, has a really good attitude, is a really good culture fit, and only retain those people. And so another principle I've just learned is when we, before someone's hired, even when my company at CompSynfo Systems had over 400 employees, before someone was hired, I would spend 5 minutes with them, often on the phone, because we're hiring in various places around the country, but just to try to understand, is this person really an A player? So why are they an A player? And then I'd only talk to the people that a manager wanted to send an offer letter to. And then I'd say either yay or nay. But when I started doing that, I was rejecting 30% of the people the executive, the managers wanted to hire. But within 6 months, I was only rejecting 10% because they all raised the bar. They had sure. They now standards. They didn't want the CEO saying, hey, no, that person doesn't seem to be an A player. So we're getting much better, I think, people. And so then we'd say, hey, 90-day probation period, 80 days, you have to tell me why that person's an A player if we're going to retain that person. And it's well, they're not yet, but maybe they will. Well, generally, they'll turn around. So we should really get someone who has a much better chance of being an A player with us. So
excellent. It's preserving the culture, making sure that there's a DNA fit right is very important.
Yes, because there are people that may make money in the short term, but they're bad culture fits, and they can be disruptive. It's just important. And then when you're doing, unfortunately, when you're a CEO and there's a recession or other challenges hit, you have to do layoffs. I've had to do three over the years. And you just try to be as humane as possible. And sometimes you say, okay, we've got to lay off, 20% of our staff. And then you just go the extra. I remember the VP of HR came in with, here's the list. And I said, gee, this woman, she's a young woman. She's a single mom. Is there any way we can keep her? Could she was the receptionist. We said we'd do without receptionist. Well, she could do, she still sit at the reception desk, but she could do these other jobs because we're all letting some people go that we're doing that. And so great. Let's keep her. You try to have that, just a heart of a compassion. Heart. Mm-hmm. And those that have to lay off sometimes they're good, capable people, you try to help them get other jobs.
Sure, absolutely. Well, very good. Well, you know, Chris, I mean, I love the whole social entrepreneurship. And you said, you know, really doing that. And you talk about, in fact, that was the theme that you chose for this year's Vision Values, is moving from success to significance. And you said definitely the social entrepreneurship has been different than what you did in the for-profit, but you've led a much richer life. And so for those people out there that are considering social entrepreneurship, you know, if God taps you on the shoulder for that, then be obedient. Right, Chris? Because, you know, he will help you figure it out.
That's right. If you just say, wow, this is such an unusual offer or invitation to apply. You know, when I was a for-profit exec, to run a nonprofit organization, but be open. And Lisa, maybe I'll take a moment to define social entrepreneur. A social enterprise can be nonprofit, probably most are nonprofit, but they can be for-profit. They're very focused on helping disadvantaged people. And so that's generally our highest focus. But those that are for-profit are also seeking to do well by doing good. They're helping those people, and they're not out raising donations, but they're trying to generate their revenues from profits to be able to provide a product or service so affordable that they can then expand their business to provide it to many other people. So I think social entrepreneurship is a great example for many of the leaders that listen to your podcast, and they can, your leaders, those that are running their companies, they might look around and say, gee, how can I use this to help disadvantaged people in the immediate community or farther away? I think of a real estate developer in Charlotte that he just said, gee, he gathered a few other real estate developers and some other CEOs with skills, and they discovered that it's so important to have early childhood education, that 90% of the brain is formed by age 5. So they said, let's go into a very disadvantaged section of town. There's an old church that's been dilapidated that may get torn down. So let's buy that church. Let's restore it. Let's make that a center. Let's hire someone from the community. There's a woman there who had a good background in early childhood education. And then she started doing this the teaching and the tutoring and all sorts of enrichment opportunities for children from babies to 5 years old, allowing mothers to be working so they have them there all day. And then they created jobs and numerous jobs. And so they just used their skills in real estate development and some of the other skills they could bring to bear. And they partnered with people in the community and listened to people in the community as to what they really needed. But so many car dealerships have done great things because if you're a leader, you've got a platform of influence, you've got a platform of capital, a platform of being able to get things done, and look at how you can use that, because it's very fulfilling when you do that. It's just it's been to help provide edify. We provide loans to schools and help them improve their education. These are, again, schools that are educating children of the working poor. Mom's making $2 or $3 a day. Dad's making about the same. And they want their children to get those educations. So it's so fulfilling to see the schools help them expand, to go from, say, 300 to 500 students, to improve their education offerings and help them teach the children how to use computers. Because if children can learn to use a computer, they are going to get a job offer, because there are so few people in many developing countries that can use computers.
Mm-hmm. So true. Well, Chris, I'm gonna wrap this up with a quote from you. Okay. And now I want to talk about something extra for a few minutes. But you said, at the end of the day, here is the question that you say we will be asked. There's going to be a day of reckoning, right? And we're going to stand, we're going to give an account for how we've used what we've been given. You said, did you use your talents to improve the world? And while you were doing it, did you tell others about me?
Absolutely.
And that's a mic drop for me. That is just such a beautiful way and a profound way of thinking about our life, at the end of our life, those two questions.
Yes, because I my faith is that I'll stand before Jesus and he'll review my life with me, and he's going to ask. He's going to quote what he said, quote himself, what he said in the New Testament, to whom much is given, much is required. So, hey, I gave you opportunities for good education, helped you in your business, helped you many other ways. Did you use that to help other people? And I know he's going to expect me to say yes. And then he's going to say, did you tell him about me? Did you share the saving knowledge of Jesus Christ, the life-transforming knowledge of having a relationship with Jesus? And he's going to expect me to say yes. And I think you just have to combine those two. But thank you, Lisa,
for bringing it up. That's awesome. The ultimate question. Well, so Chris, what do you believe? This is the Something Extra podcast. What do you believe is the something extra that every leader needs?
It's two things, in my opinion, Lisa, and I've alluded to both, but it's looking for opportunities to use your God-given talents to significantly help disadvantaged people, so less fortunate people, whether it's nearby or in your state or your country or in other countries, because there is a way that your talents are needed. It might be serving on the board of a nonprofit that's really doing great things, that has a great need for your particular skills. It could be so many other things. It might be when you sell your company or you depart from your where you're employed, that you decide to be an executive, a chief operating officer, a CEO at a nonprofit, or just come alongside a CEO in organizations like that, or executive director, and help to give them advice so that they can avoid pitfalls and take greater advantage of opportunities. So that's number one. And number two is mentoring. It's, gosh, you leaders that are listening, you've been gifted with the chance to be a leader, with the experience you have, the education you have. So look for younger leaders that you can mentor to help them to be better, to help more people, to be compassionate, to lead so that they engender trust in those that they are leading, and to help them be the best leaders they can be, because you, as the mentor, will have such great joy in doing this. And if I may say, the latest organization that I've co-founded is Ardent Mentoring, and it's a community of Christian mentors that are seeking to mentor social entrepreneurs, whether the social entrepreneurs are Christian or not. But if the social entrepreneurs are seeking to help disadvantaged people, this is a place to come to receive mentoring from highly accomplished entrepreneurs and people with other skills and other disciplines that can help you make the most of good opportunities and avoid the pitfalls that can set you back a few years or sync your organization. So that's at www.ardentmentoring.org.
Good. I was going to ask you, please tell our listeners, because there may be somebody out there, Chris, that wants to check that out. So thank you so much for sharing that URL. Well, listen, my friend, I think I could talk to you for hours and hours and hours, but we're not going to do that to our listeners today. But I so appreciate you making the time to be on the show. And we've covered such a wide variety of different topics here, things that are really important. And I know that your story and your wisdom is going to be able to help those that are listening to the Something Extra podcast. So thank you, my friend, for being on the show today.
Lisa, thank you so much for having me. And this is a great social entrepreneurship enterprise you're doing. You are sharing important concepts with, just look at the list of podcast guests you've had and the important things they've said. That's indirect mentoring, and you're helping many people with what you're doing. Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to today's show. Something Extra with Lisa Nichols is a Technology Partners production. Copyright Technology Partners, Inc., 2019. For show notes or to reach Lisa, visit tpi.co/podcast. Don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen.